I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in.
Max Lugavere is a filmmaker, health and science journalist, and the author of the New York Times bestselling books, Genius Foods and The Genius Life. He is also the host of the chart-topping health podcast, The Genius Life. Max appears regularly on the Dr. Oz Show, The Rachel Ray Show, and The Doctors, and he is passionate about sharing health information, research, and tips to his community on Instagram. This April, he is releasing his first cookbook, Genius Kitchen, over 100 easy and delicious recipes to make your brain sharp, body strong, and taste buds happy. Max is a dear friend, and it is a pleasure to welcome him back to the show. Max!
Kelly.
I'm like, are you a double offender or are you a triple threat? How many times have you been on my, we've been like on each other's podcast so many times, and we're friends. So it's just like, it's wonderful to have you back and so fun for you to be here. So thanks for coming.
No, of course. Thank you. I'm super excited about Genius Kitchen, the new book. And also anytime you want to jump back on my podcast, my listeners love you.
It goes both ways.
Which is not surprising. I love any chance I get to collab with you. It's awesome.
Well, let's talk about your new book, Genius Kitchen. When does it drop? What is it all about? And why did you decide to go into a cookbook? Why did you just decide to develop a cookbook?
Well, it's such a good question and great place to start. I think cooking is where the rubber meets the road, right? With regard to all of the nutrition knowledge that one has amassed through their over the course of their health journey. And it really comes down to the meals that you're eating 3 times a day, 2 times a day. And if you're not able to take the knowledge that you've acquired and turn it into delicious, satiating, nourishing meals that you can actually show up and eat again and again and again, then whatever your knowledge is, it's going to be useless to you, right? So I really wanted to take all of the nutritional guidance, all of the recommendations that I've made, and also where my feelings on certain food components have evolved, and turn them into delicious dishes. Because food is such an incredible gift. It's how we communicate with one another. It's how we bond. You know, we often have meetings or go on dates with a shared meal. Cooking for loved ones is an incredible way to show love. It's also a way to impart health, right? Like if you have the knowledge of what it means to eat healthily that you've gleaned from listening to Kelly's podcast or my podcast or reading our books, it's what I can't think of a better gift than to be able to craft a delicious meal with all of that nutritional information that you've amassed to impart that health onto somebody that you care about. I mean, it's the most amazing gift there is. And that's actually how I got, I've always, I think, had a knack for cooking, but my journey in the kitchen was really catalyzed and accelerated by the fact that my mom got sick. And when she was no longer able to cook for the family, that's something that I took upon myself to then carry the torch forward and to create dishes for her and for my brothers. And the meals that I wanted to create for my mom, because my mom was saddled with chronic illness for so long, were dishes that I knew were going to be palatable to her, that were going to be delicious to her, and that were going to remind her of her comfort foods, but that also were going to nourish her body and help support her brain health. And yeah, that was a journey that began about 10 years ago. All of my favorite dishes, everything that I've learned about cooking, it's all laid out in Genius Kitchen. We've talked a lot, I think, about how health literacy is something that has been outsourced. We live in the era of specialization, right? And so we outsource health literacy the same way that we outsource financial literacy, the same way that we outsource so many aspects of what it means to be a self-sufficient human being. But culinary literacy is just one more area of the human experience that I feel like we've long neglected, because now, you know, we have smartphones. We can order dishes that show up at our doorsteps 15 minutes later, right? We live in a world where fast food is ubiquitous. And so I want to bring culinary literacy back to the table, no pun intended. And I want to provide people with a really easy roadmap to create super delicious dishes that were both nourishing and satiating and involve low cost, easy to access ingredients too, because that's something that's really important to me, food accessibility.
So important. And we're going to dive into that later in the podcast. I'd love to unpack culinary literacy and how it happened for you personally. Obviously, it was a hard road with your mom, and you were forced to kind of get in the kitchen and get going. But what were some of those first meals that you learned to make that you suggest for your followers, your audience, your readers to get started? Because it can feel overwhelming, especially if you need to rely on recipes. But like, where, you know, how did it really work for you in becoming comfortable in the kitchen?
Yeah, there's this weird disfigured version of the Mediterranean diet that exists in the medical, the orthodox medical literature that includes grain and seed oils like canola oil. And they refer to the Mediterranean diet as being a grain-based diet. But for anybody that's actually been to the Mediterranean region of the world, you won't find canola oil in an Italian kitchen, right? So for me, it was really about examining authentically what dietary patterns truly are associated with reduced risk for cardiovascular disease, for neurodegenerative disease. And when you look at the Mediterranean diet and you break it apart, really what it is, it's a diet that incorporates lots of healthy fats, and the fats tend to be monounsaturated fatty acids. So mono, chemically stable monounsaturated fats dominate the Mediterranean dietary pattern. And you find those fats in extra virgin olive oil. Extra virgin olive oil is the primary oil. You can also find those fats in avocado oil, but to be totally honest, they don't use a lot of avocado oil in the Mediterranean diet. Mm-hmm. But I love both. Both are great. Both are chemically stable, as I mentioned, super, super healthy. And extra virgin olive oil in particular, you can look at, there's so many different grades of evidence that you can look to supporting its wide utility in the kitchen. You can use it to cook with. It's a myth that you can't cook with it. In fact, in the Mediterranean region of the world, they cook with extra virgin olive oil all the time. They use it as a sauce. They even create desserts with extra virgin olive oil. I have two of those desserts in Genius Kitchen. I have an extra virgin olive oil sugar-free ice cream and an extra virgin, and an extra virgin olive oil almond cake, all grain-free, sugar-free. So it's that. It's starting with healthy fats. It's integrating. It's integrating a smaller number of higher quality ingredients. So Mediterranean cooking, it's all about simplicity. It's all about getting rid of the extraneous ingredients that just complicate matters in the kitchen, and bringing under the fold higher quality ingredients, but a smaller array of them. So high quality salt, pepper, garlic powder, for example. And with those base level ingredients, you can grill or roast veggies super easily and make them super delicious. You can do the same with meat, wild salmon, grass-fed beef, poultry, things like that. So that's really where I started, was like, I got rid of any preconception that I had about the Mediterranean dietary pattern, and I started from a clean slate. And when you realize that it's about simplicity, and then you start from there, you realize that some of the most delicious recipes that you'll have very few ingredients. It's just, it's the combination of salt, of the right fats, of the really nuanced bitter flavors that you find in, for example, extra virgin olive oil, or some of the dark leafy greens that you see a lot in Mediterranean cooking. So I started there, and then obviously, you know, as your skills sharpen, you develop your skills as a chef, you can add complexity. But that is like the starting place, like simplicity, plants, animal products. That's it.
Healthy fats. Yeah. You talked about extra virgin olive oil being chemically stable, and it's a myth that you can't cook with it. And it's funny because in my first book, Body Love, when it was all about smoke points back in 2016, and we were talking about the degradation of oils and the inflammatory like byproducts of oils that are cooked over a smoke point, I didn't cook with olive oil. And then come to my second book, Body Love Every Day, and we're looking at the stability of like antioxidants that are still present in olive oils when cooking around like a caramelized factor, like between like 350 and 400, and that it is you're totally capable of cooking at that heat. And it's unfortunate that books can't be updated in the same way that like a website can, because it's so delicious when your veggies are roasted in olive oil. Like all you need is a good olive oil and salt, and you feel like you're at a restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a difference with regard to cooking between dry heat and moist heat, right? And so you might see a smoke point of 350 degrees, for example, on the bottle of on a bottle of extra virgin olive oil, but that's just a generic recommendation. If you're heating the oil past that in a pan, for example, with no other ingredients, then it might start to smoke.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're using that to roast vegetables in, vegetables have a very high moisture content.
Right.
At a temperature in the oven of about 400 degrees, the moisture is going to protect the oil. Right. So I wouldn't necessarily worry about temperatures so much. And also, I think it's important for people to know that smoke point is really more of it's mostly a culinary concern. So it has no bearing on the temperature at which point an oil becomes pro-carcinogenic.
Right.
In fact, some of the oils with some of the grain and seed oils that are heavily marketed, super high profit margins, like canola oil, corn oil, soybean oil, they boast very, very high smoke points. And they're engineered as such to have really high smoke points, but they degrade and they oxidize and they generate those pro-inflammatory compounds at far lower temperatures.
Right. So let's unpack what's in your pantry, what's in your kitchen. You're obviously using extra virgin olive oil. You're using a lower number of like high quality proteins and vegetables. But what are some of those everyday meals that are in your book that you're making for yourself? And are you using your recipes, or do you kind of have them in the back of your head now?
Yeah, well, at this point, I feel like you develop a little bit of kitchen know-how. The more recipes you create, the more... It's sort of like the rising tide that lifts all the boats in your harbor. There's a spillover effect. So the more recipes that you create, the better of a chef you become. And also, it's really important to taste as you go. There are no points to be won by not tasting your food until it's quote unquote finished, right? I think we put a lot of ego, right, into the dishes that we create. But first of all, if you're not having fun while you're cooking, you're losing half the battle. It's sort of like karaoke is an analogy that I make in the book, right? You could be a pop star, you could be the worst singer in the world. But as long as you're having fun up on that stage, people are going to have fun watching you, right? So you got to have fun cooking. Whether you're the worst cook or whether you are the best cook, a seasoned chef, you have to have fun doing it. And you have to taste provided that it's safe to do so, your dishes as you cook, because flavors develop over time, textures develop over time. So that's I think a really important part of it. You also, I think it's really worthwhile, just as a general cooking tip, to read the entirety of the recipe before you start cooking. This is a mistake that I've made many, many times in the past, right?
I'm laughing over here because that is key. Like it's a game changer. You'll miss something and it can mess up the whole thing. But also you learn technique. There are so many techniques I've learned from just reading recipes, even if I don't make them. When I'm trying to decide what I'm going to make for the week, I tend to like make things that are just staples. And in my brain, I know how to make tacos. I know how to make whole roasted chicken and roasted veggies. Like I know how to make like zoodles and pasta when I'm doing pasta night for my family. Like who wants zoodles? Who wants pasta? Who wants a blend? You know, that kind of a thing with the kiddos. But every week I'll like pick a couple new recipes, read them, look at them and decide like, oh, I'm going to try this from the New York Times. Or I'm going to try this from Genius Life Kitchen. Like, you know, whatever it is, it's like reading the recipe in its entirety. I may not have all the ingredients, but I may just hack it and make it knowing that like, I might not have these specialty ingredients you're talking about, but hey, it's teaching me a new technique on how to make a, I don't know, like a turkey chili or like something of that nature.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, I have a recipe for a vegan carrot noodle mac and cheese in my book. Mm. I do have some plant-based recipes in my book.
What? You're not a dogmatic paleo guy. We're going to unpack that in a little bit. No,
yes. but yeah, it's so good. It's so decadent. Yeah. So I love like spiralized any vegetable, really. Yeah.
So what are your go-tos?
Well, so I love that recipe. That recipe is amazing. There's a recipe that I created that harks back to one of my favorite things to eat as a kid. I grew up in New York City. And in New York City, we have these pizza places, and often they sell Jamaican beef patties, which are loaded. When I was a kid, they were probably loaded with partially hydrogenated fats, which are terrible for you, refined white flour, you name it. But I love them. They tasted so good. They were so savory. So I made it my mission to recreate that dish in Genius Kitchen. And it's a pattyless Jamaican beef patty, which has just, we use grass-fed ground beef, which is, by the way, one of the most economical ways to integrate grass-finished beef into your diet. It's so inexpensive, and Trader Joe's now carries it. You just use a handful of spices, and then the kicker is nutritional yeast, which really adds an incredible savory, almost umami flavor to the dish that, and also the color of nutritional yeast makes it look a lot like the Jamaican beef patty that I used to eat growing up. So it's like, we nailed it. And so that's one of my go-tos. I love that recipe so much. Totally healthy, nourishing. And also it kind of illustrates a general theme of my book. So I borrow and am inspired by lots of different types of international cuisine because I grew up in New York City, as I mentioned, and I went to school in Miami. So for me, my palate has been honed by exposure to the bold flavors that international cuisine provides. Another favorite dish of mine in the book is actually probably the dish in the book that's most special with regard to the relationship that I had with my mom. It's a bacalao dish. Bacalao is like a Portuguese dish. And it involves salted cod, which can be found in most supermarkets. It's just dehydrated salted cod, which is this flaky, high protein, very lean fish. And it's, again, this like international dish. My mom, for some reason, we're not Portuguese, but my mom used to make it for me. And I was the only person in my family that ate fish. My brothers didn't like fish. So it was this special bond that me and her both shared that she would make it for me. And it has olives in it. And she used white potatoes, but I swapped them out for sweet potatoes, which I think really go nicely with the acid flavor imparted by the olives. So it's like this Portuguese bacalao dish, which is incredible. I have a bunch of sweet dishes in there. I have this really great, we might've even talked about it on the last time I was on your show, this dark chocolate covered fresh blueberry dessert dish. Mm. Yeah, it's super simple to make. So my dishes range in complexity, but this one in particular, I've never seen this done before. And both dark chocolate and blueberries are so good for the brain. So I felt, why not try to combine them? So what you do is you melt down a dark chocolate bar. You want to make sure that it's high cacao percentage. So I generally look for 85% cacao or higher. You melt it down in a double boiler, or you kind of pulse a very low heat on in a saucepan because you don't want to burn the chocolate. Mm-hmm. You throw in a little bit of coconut oil, some monk fruit sweetener, and then you take it off the heat. You drop the blueberries in there. You make sure that they're well coated, and then you scoop the little clusters onto some parchment paper. Yeah. You sprinkle with some sea salt. You throw them in the fridge for 20 minutes, and then you get these amazing like clusters of chocolate coated dark blueberries. So you've got this like hard chocolate shell, and then this explosion of that like delicious blueberry flavor in your mouth. Kids love them, by the way. They're so good.
I'm going to make those for the boys for sure, because it kind of reminds me if like I grew up in SoCal, right? So I didn't have the culinary explosion that you grew up with. I really had like the Costco staples. So for me, there were these chocolate blueberries that my parents used to buy in a huge, big white bag. And it's like probably the worst of the worst. Like,
were they dried?
Yeah. And they were covered in sugar and dried. And we all know the brand, or people I'm sure listening are like, I know that brand she's talking about, those chocolate covered blueberries. But like right there, it's like, those are the kind of inspiring recipes where I'm like, You don't need to give me the exact proportions. Like, I know how to go whip that together for the boys. And that's a really fun, like nutrient dense dessert. That these are the kind of swaps as moms and as regular people who just want, if you want to lower your sugar intake, increase your nutrient density, like get in the kitchen, mess up, but like, no, you're not going to mess up totally. Like not have to have the perfect proportions, like maybe your almond olive oil cake, but have it good enough to where you're like, yeah, that was delicious. I can do that again and hone my craft and grab the recipe and make it happen.
It must feel so good. Like, you know, cause I don't have kids. I have a cat and I take pride in feeding her the healthiest cat food that I can find. Right.
You're going to be a great dad when that time comes, Max.
If I had a kid though, I think that I would really love the feeling of making something nourishing like these like blueberry clusters for them that they also really enjoy. Feels like a treat, but knowing like what I'm doing with respect to their brain health, right? We know how good dark chocolate is from a brain health standpoint. We know the value that blueberries play because of the anthocyanins. So it's really, again, such a powerful way to express love.
It is. And you know what? You're exactly hitting the point. Like that's the kind of recipe where I will actually probably have Sebastian help me, because we're talking, not only is he getting exposure to like getting in the kitchen and learning this stuff that, you know, I think for our generation, our parents would make our food and plate it up for us at dinner. We'd all sit down post sports, post school and be like, shovel it in and then go about our day. And so when our parents were given faster options and packaged options, like canned foods, whatever the case may be, they didn't have to lean on their culinary expertise. And so there's this resurgence in our generation of people who like want to get in the kitchen. They want to learn how to make things. They want to make things from scratch. They want to pull the emulsifiers, the fillers, like, and there's this want. And then there is, I think, the hard part of people butting up against time. Like, I don't have the time to do this, or I have other things going on. And I always really love for my clients and the people that I work with to make the time to think about like, how are you educating your kids? Like if I'm going to talk to Bash about the colors, well, chocolate is brown and blueberries are blue, or I'm going to talk about the benefits or like the texture, that like anything can be educational. So I love educating in the kitchen, because I just know like exposure and modeling and all of that is going to improve his eating throughout his whole life. It's the number one predictor. So these kind of recipes, quick and easy, I think people get in their mind that they have to be Martha Stewart. And it's like, no, like you have to be consistent. You have to like feel comfortable. You have to have fun, exactly what you're saying. So that, I'm on a little soapbox, but that being said, like what, the Jamaican beef patties and your Peruvian dish, how do you pronounce it?
Yeah, it's bacalao.
Bacalao.
Yeah.
Like they sound kind of time intensive. Like what are some of your fastest, easiest recipes where someone can start if they're picking up Genius Kitchen?
That's a great question. Also, I want to add, because I mean your soliloquy there was like so important. There was so much there to unpack, but there's this saying that a well person has 100 wishes, right? But a sick person has just one, to be healthy. So health is really the most important thing, and we have to keep the most important thing the most important thing. So you make time. You have to make time. And cooking is the number one leverage point. Cooking at home, nutrition nerds like us, we love to talk about carbs, fat, ratios, all that stuff, right? But cooking at home, just doing that is such an incredibly potent leverage, point of leverage for better health. You can cook the same dish at home that you'd get at a restaurant, and it's going to have less calories, less fat calories, less sodium. People who cook at home more as opposed to eating out more, they have lower risk of having a too high body mass index, so lower risk of obesity. They tend to have healthier body fat percentages. They tend to have better cardiometabolic health. We know that cooking at home with your family improves family dynamics, right? This is something that my mom instilled in me and my younger brothers, and I come from a really small family, but one of her core values was every night we would have dinner together as a family. We would catch up on each other's days, right? And that strengthens the family unit. It also chills you out so that you can activate that parasympathetic rest and digest mode, whereas eating on the go, we know, destroys your digestion. So super important. And I think like just knowing that will be motivation enough for many of your listeners. But the really simple recipes, I mean, you know, I think most people don't even know how to cook a simple burger patty. Like I was saying that grass-fed, grass-finished ground beef is one of the most economical, nutrient-dense foods in the supermarket, right? By the way, we're not dogmatic here. Even if it's not grass-fed, grass-finished, ground beef is still so nutrient-dense, right? It's a way better option for dinner than boxed mac and cheese.
Absolutely.
And so just knowing how to cook a burger patty, I think, is something that most people screw up. Most people, when they make a burger patty, and I used to do this before I learned, people mix salt into the ground beef, right? They mix salt and spices, maybe some chopped onions, thinking that they're
making fancy.
Like, yeah, they're getting fancy with it, but they're actually ruining the burger patty. First of all, when you mix salt into ground beef, it changes the proteins and the texture of the beef. What you end up getting is more of like a sausage, because sausage meat has sodium mixed in and it gels the meat. I'm not sure the scientific term, but it coagulates the meat. It changes the proteins. They cross-link together. And that's where you get that more rubbery texture that's appropriate for a sausage, but inappropriate for a burger patty, right? The vegetable bits that oftentimes we throw in the middle, those vegetables are not going to caramelize in the time that it takes to properly cook your burger patty. That's why you go to the supermarket sometimes and you see those preformed burger patties with like cheese and onion chunks in it.
Yeah, green like pepper, just, and you're like, gross.
Yeah, you're just going to have an overcooked burger with raw onion chunks in the middle. It's like not good. So the best way to make a burger patty, which you can eat on top of a bed of greens, you can eat it on a salad, you can eat it by itself. You can throw an egg on it. There's so many ways to use just a grass-fed beef patty. No seasoning. You just throw, you form the burger patty. You make it as flat as you can. It helps to actually use your thumb to put an indent in the top. And you get a cast iron pan nice and hot. You don't need to add any oil to the pan because the burger, particularly if it's well seasoned, which is important. And I give instructions on how to do that in the book. But a well-seasoned cast iron pan, you don't need any added oil when you're cooking something fatty like a ground beef patty. You also don't need to add oil when you're cooking a steak that has a fat cap on it. But you throw the burger patty in the pan, no salt. And then on the side that's on the face upside, then from about 6 inches away, you sprinkle some coarse salt on top. And then you do the same after you flip the burger. That's it. You put the salt on just before cooking it. And the same, by the way, also applies to cooking steak. Some steak purists love to pre-salt their steaks. You don't have to do that. The key to making a good steak is to make sure that it's dry before putting the steak in the pan. This is a big mistake that many people make. Some people rinse their steaks. Terrible idea. But in general, putting salt on before the meat will cause water to come to the surface. And you want to make sure that the surface of the meat is dry because otherwise you're going to steam the steak. It's going to come out gross. You want to cook it. You want to develop that nice thick crust. And the way to do that is to make sure that the steak that you're putting in is dry. If the steak has a fat cap, you can use tongs and put the fat cap down first for a few minutes just to render out some of that fat so you get a nice tallow on the surface of the pan. If there's no fat on it, if you're cooking a tenderloin, for example, then it's appropriate to use a little bit of oil. I would use an avocado oil, which has a high smoke point. Or I would use I would probably go for an avocado oil, maybe ghee, if I'm feeling really indulgent. So yeah, those are some basics. I think it's really important to know how to cook both of those two staples.
Well, those were such great tips. Just because I can't eat, I'm sure 90% of the people listening are salting up their steak, bringing water to the top of their steak, throwing it on a pan that's not hot enough, not getting that sear, getting that, you know, kind of like gray brown look when they flip it over. Like, what a bummer. Because you could have this amazing crust to just hold in all those juices and get that perfect medium rare or rare, however you normally take it. I love that. Such good stuff. And also, like, just the burger patty itself, like the speed and efficiency in which that's made when you aren't adding all those extras and you're just like pulling it out of the package, making a patty, throwing it in your pan. Like, these are the types of things that don't need to be made on a barbecue if you know how to do it right with those tips. Do you have any other tips like that, that you see people making mistakes in the kitchen, that like steaming their steak, that may just need a slight tweak to get like the best tasting meal?
Yeah, I would say one of the big, if not the biggest mistake that home novice cooks make is they under season their food. They undersalt their food. That's pretty much it. I mean, that's like the biggest mistake. This is one of the reasons why so many of us, the vast majority of sodium that Americans consume come from restaurant foods and packaged processed foods. But only 11% of the sodium that your average American intakes comes from their own salt shaker. And undersalting food is a major problem. Some of the healthiest foods in the supermarket are super bland unless you add salt. Salt is the number one way to make a piece of meat, for example, and turn it into a steak. And so you got to get comfortable using an appropriate amount of salt. It's just really important. It's a very valuable macronutrient. Micronutrient. It's a macro mineral, meaning we need to ingest a relatively large amount of it every day for good health. And if you are on a path to wellness and you've reduced your consumption of ultra processed foods and you're cooking at home more because you know of the health benefits of just doing that alone, then you really have to think about where your salt is coming from. Right. And then you throw into the mix low carb dieting, which isn't appropriate for everybody, but many people enjoy low carb diets. You throw in vigorous activity, sauna use, exercise, et cetera. And where your salt is coming from becomes a really important question. And it is the one, I think, primary mistake that most home cooks make. They undersalt their food. They undersalt their food.
And then they have cravings for restaurant food and they don't love the food that they're making and then they don't make it as often.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So whenever you're seasoning your roasted veggies and your recipes, you're using a fine salt and then a coarse salt for proteins and a flake salt for finishing.
Yeah. 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 And the flake salt, I mean, I can't underscore how valuable it is with especially with certain dishes. But I mean, vegetables, just before serving, you throw a little bit of flake salt on it. It really is like, it's one of these like cheap ways to really increase the production value of your food.
Really impressing people at your house. Sounds like something I'd throw on those chocolate covered blueberries too, just to get that real zinger.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so let's talk about what your days look like, because you've mentioned some budget-friendly ideas like a ground beef, for example. But in looking like a week in life of you, what are some meals that are on repeat almost every week?
Good question. I feel like, well, for me, I'm big on grilled proteins and whole plants. And I do tend to eat the same thing quite a bit. There was actually a study, a Tufts University study, that found that people who adhere to the advice to just eat everything in moderation, you know, it's like the dogma that even is still echoed today from like the nutritional orthodoxy, like just, you know, there are no food rules, just eat all things and all foods fit, everything in moderation. And that's certainly good advice, I guess, for some who are trying to heal a fractured relationship with food, but that also happens to be the mantra of the junk food industry, right? That all foods fit. It's not our fault you're overweight. It's the fact that it's your fault that you weren't able to moderate your consumption of our Cheetos or our Pringles or our sugar sweetened beverages, right?
Right.
So what this study found is that the healthiest people actually tend to buy a narrower range of more healthful foods, and they buy those foods on loop. So for me, I eat a lot of egg dishes like every day. I try to get in 2 to 3 whole eggs. Sometimes I'll supplement and I'll put in like, you know, 2 to 3 whole eggs, and then I'll use some pre-separated egg whites. Like, you can find those at most supermarkets, even Costco. I find that to be a great way to get all of the nutritional benefits of whole eggs, which mm-hmm. we know are significant, mm-hmm. while also increasing the protein proportion, like the protein density.
Getting your protein intake for the day up. Mm-hmm.
For those gains.
Yeah, huge gains to be swole.
Yeah. Swole patrol. 100%. Yeah.
So I just want to take a minute and take a beat here. The majority of women that I work with are eating suboptimal amounts of protein. So while I joke with Max, protein intake is super critically important for blood sugar balance, for hunger hormone regulation, for energy, for feeling your best, for the production of neurotransmitters, hormones, skin, muscle cells, you name it. So even though I'm teasing Max right now, if women are listening, protein intake is critically important for all of us.
It's super important. And it's not going to, my goal may be to get swole, right?
Yeah.
But it's not just eating more protein is not going to make you swole, right? I mean, getting swole has to do with genetics. It has to do with gender. It has to do with training style. There's so many factors that come into play, but you're right. Protein is this totally underappreciated macronutrient, and women tend to shy away from it.
Right. It is what has my clients eating spontaneously less and feeling more full and satisfied. So just had to throw in that little caveat, because sometimes when I joke and people don't realize, like, you know, I really do care about how much protein I'm eating every day and what my clients are ingesting too.
Yeah. I mean, we know now at this point that for health, people with healthy kidneys, there's really no risk to consuming a high protein diet. There are seemingly only benefits in terms of body recomposition, in terms of filling you up, making you feel that gratifying sense of fullness. I mean, you mentioned the brain connection, but also high protein foods tend to have a lot of other really valuable micronutrients that tag along. And particularly micronutrients that we tend to underconsume, like vitamin B12, zinc, choline, things like that. So I generally prioritize protein at every meal. And I also really try to prioritize protein for my snacking as well. I mean, I don't always hit the target that I want to, but I won't eat anything for the day before I've had a good dose of protein. So my first meal of the day, I'm not snacking before my first meal of the day. The first meal of the day isn't to me a meal unless it's got a significant portion of protein. And for me, usually it's going to be some kind of fish, salmon, grass-fed beef. I'm okay with poultry, pork. I mean, it really doesn't matter what it is, but it's getting in like a good 30 to 40 grams of protein for me. And then I'll usually add in some kind of fiber source, so some kind of whole plant. Usually it's like a salad or some type of roasted veggie. We know that fiber is satiating because it mechanically stretches out the stomach because fiber absorbs water. And that's really it for me for my first meal of the day. And the second meal of my last meal of the day tends to look a lot like that, actually. And then if I'm snacking, I try to like prioritize high protein snacks. Like there's a brand of, I guess it's not really a beef jerky, but there's a company called Carnivore Crisps, and they create like all these different like sliced meats that just have salt. There's no added sugar. And my favorite, actually, I was like really into the ribeye for a while, the brisket, but actually after trying all of their products and having been a customer for a couple of months at this point, my favorite product that they make is just the sliced chicken breast. It's like sliced dried chicken breast chips. Just with salt, it's very lean, very high protein, highly satiating. So I've ordered like a ton of those. So I'll snack on those throughout the day.
I'll have to give those a try. Do you have a code for your listeners? Have you engaged them for an affiliate code yet? We'll throw it in the show notes.
I do have a code. It's code genius. And okay. I use that code for myself, by the way.
Yeah, so. I'm going to use it too. I have never tried them before, so I'll give it a go.
Yeah. I use it. I order with that code. So, I'll snack on that throughout the day. I'm also a big like fan of whole fruit. So, you know, generally every day I have like I'll eat like a grass-fed apple.
Grass-fed apple.
Yeah. A grass-grown, like Honeycrisp apple I'm a huge fan of. And then Greek yogurt. I've been like doing a little bit more dairy just to see how I respond to it. And because my feelings on dairy have sort of evolved over the past couple of months, so I've been doing a little bit more dairy as well.
Yeah, let's unpack that a little bit. I know you and I both know that we're less dogmatic than maybe people think we are. We'll put it that way. Like, yeah. It's about following the science, about being open. For me personally, dairy is a staple when I'm pregnant. Like those first couple months when I'm nauseous, like I rely the heck on Good Culture cottage cheese, like just the plain cottage cheese with salt and pepper, like nothing sweet, but just like give me that. And also like a plain Greek yogurt. I saw the other day that you posted that you're putting cream in your coffee. Let's talk about dairy. Like, what science is coming out for you? Why did you decide to explore it for yourself personally? And how are you feeling about it right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I guess having been exposed for so long to the wellness industry, like there's this sort of, first of all, there's a push towards plant-based everything these days, right? That certainly applies to coffee creamers and the like. And I use almond milk. So like if I'm eating a, you know, sometimes I have like a keto cereal, like Magic Spoon, which I know we're both fans of, right? Like I'll eat that with like an almond milk, even though Magic Spoon is
way protein.
Yeah,
but it's not like the lactose sugar. Yeah.
Right, exactly, exactly. So I really wanted to like look into the claims being made about dairy, that it's pro-inflammatory and all this stuff. And actually, meta-analyses really don't see a pro-inflammatory effect from dairy. Now, 75% of the adult population is lactose intolerant, so that's true. And some people do see, for example, their mucus production go down when they remove dairy. Acne improves. It is a very common allergen. So I'm not saying rush out and go start eating dairy if you know that you're sensitive to it. But for people who aren't sensitive to it, full fat dairy does have a number of really interesting micronutrients that I think could potentially play a valuable role in health. It's interesting to note that dairy's purpose is to grow a baby into a more grown, developed version of that organism, right? In the case of bovine dairy, it's to grow a calf into a cow,
right?
But what is the organ that's under most rapid growth and development, right? The organ that accounts for the vast majority of a neonate's resting metabolic rate. It's the brain. Mm-hmm. And so if you actually look at what dairy fat is comprised of, there are some compounds in dairy fat that are very beneficial from the standpoint of the brain. And research has shown that people are concerned about the saturated fat in dairy. Saturated fat in dairy is very unique in that it doesn't have a negative effect on LDL cholesterol. And it's thought that this is attributed to the presence of something called milk fat globule membrane. So they've shown that full fat dairy, cream, for example, actually has, when you feed it in a clinical trial to a human, there's no increase in LDL, which you would otherwise normally see with most saturated fatty acids, right?
Right.
However, butter is a dairy product. It's the only dairy product where that milk fat globule membrane has been disrupted. And so when you feed somebody butter, you will see their LDL levels go up. Mm-hmm. So it seems that this milk fat globule membrane, it changes our response to dairy fat. And observationally, we see that people who consume full fat dairy, they don't have worse cardiovascular health. They have better cardiovascular health. They have lower risk of type 2 diabetes. And when you actually break apart what is in this milk fat globule membrane, I had to look because I'm like, what is the purpose of milk, right? It's full of phospholipids like phosphatidylcholine, which we know is really important. No. Yeah, phenomenal. This is in full fat dairy. It's not found in reduced fat or low fat dairy. I mean, it's not found in butter. It's also rich in a compound called sphingomyelin, which is an important constituent of myelin, which is the insulation that wraps around your neurons that helps your brain cells communicate with one another effectively.
Right. I always like use the example of it. It's nylons over your nerves. It's a nylon sheath. it's protecting. It's protecting those communication superhighways.
Exactly. So full fat dairy seems to have all these like interesting aspects to it. And I also went to look to see if there was any evidence relating dairy consumption with reduced risk, for example, or risk in general for Alzheimer's disease. Maybe it increased risk, maybe it lowered risk. But actually, there was a study that came out a couple years ago. not the highest quality study, but this is true. This is often the case with nutrition, unfortunately. But it was published by this guy, Oriol Willett, whose work I've been following for some time. He does a lot of research on the relationship between food, dietary patterns, food components, and brain health. And he found that in this food frequency questionnaire-based study, dairy consumption seemed to be the most protective diet component against cognitive decline. So it's a correlation. It's not necessarily causation. But yeah, I've become a fan of like full fat dairy, and I've been integrating, as you pointed out, heavy cream into my coffee in the morning, which is it's so much better than any of these like plant based creamers.
Yeah,
in my opinion, yeah. There's trace lactose, trace casein. It's not going to break your quote unquote fast in the functional sense because there's no carbs, there's no protein. Mm-hmm. It mixes really easily. You don't need to blend it. It's got that milk fat globule membrane, which provides all those cool brain compounds.
Whereas like a bulletproof coffee may raise your LDL, it may not.
There you go. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I enjoy the taste of bulletproof coffee, but yeah, cream doesn't have a negative effect on LDL cholesterol, but butter does. And I'm not like a big, oh my God, we got to drive our LDL, down as low as possible, but there's no need to drive it up if we don't have to. And I'm probably genetically prone to hypercholesterolemia myself. So, so I'm always looking at ways of doing better by my cardiovascular system, and heavy cream seems to be like beneficial.
So many nuggets of knowledge this podcast. I love how casual this conversation is, but how you always bring the science. I've always appreciated that about you, Max. So thank you for sharing these nuggets, because there are people out there who are choking down their coffee every morning thinking that they shouldn't be having cream, but maybe that's a totally great option for them versus whatever cheap plant-based creamer full of emulsifiers and fillers and sugar that they're using.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, heavy whipping cream, there's no carbs, there's no protein. It's just pure dairy fat that has that milk fat globule membrane in it. It mixes super easily. It's decadent. It's a lot less processed than these plant-based products. It is a little goes a long way because it's so creamy. So you're not adding very many calories to your coffee.
Right.
If you're consuming it while fasted, it's going to slow the infusion rate of the caffeine. So, I mean, I like black coffee too, don't get me wrong, but
less jitters.
Yeah. Less jitters.
Anxiety effects. Yeah,
exactly. And you also can use it to make whipped cream with a little bit of monk fruit in it. Right. And know that it's actually really healthy.
Yum.
Yum.
Okay, we got a couple more questions. You live in Los Angeles. I recently moved out of Los Angeles to the burbs. I miss my access to food and eating out at some of the most, health forward, health conscious restaurants that make that kind of stuff available. What's your philosophy on eating out versus eating at home? And like, are you meal prepping on the weekends? Are you taking it day by day? How do you go when it comes to food?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I eat out a lot.
But you also have access to Erewhon.
I have access to Erewhon. Yeah. And I eat out, when I say a lot, I mean, people are going to be like, oh, the privilege, but no, I really enjoy fast casual dining. So like, I go to restaurants with my brother sometimes, but I also enjoy like, I'll go to like one of these salad chains or Erewhon or what have you. And I like the convenience and ease of that. Right. Especially when I'm on the run, but I also really enjoy cooking. I think that it's a really important like leverage point for better health. And part of that has to do with the fact that when you cook, you know exactly what you're putting in your body. Mm-hmm. You really have no idea in restaurants. I was actually, there's a big salad chain that I don't want to call them out, but it's like the biggest salad chain that fast casual that listeners are going to be familiar with. And I called them out a couple years ago for using their quote unquote house made dressings, using grapeseed oil, which
I remember that.
Yeah, I did.
I got so many DMs.
Yeah, this was in 2018. I wrote this blog and I really wanted because I thought it was important, right? You go to one of these salad chains having your salad for the day, which is your big healthy meal, right? And what a shame then to be drenching you know, those healthful greens and those and that protein with this grapeseed oil crap, which is like a throwaway product that, you know, is huge business, but it's like, it's literally a byproduct of the winemaking industry. Like it was like, they used to throw away grapeseeds until some winemaker decided that you could press them, run them through innumerable industrial processes, and you end up with this tasteless, polyunsaturated dominant oil. And now it's everywhere. It's got an omega 6 to omega 3 ratio of 700 to 1. It's predominantly this like really easily oxidized polyunsaturated oil, polyunsaturated fat, and so the house made dressings were made primarily of that. And yeah, that was like a big, that to me made me feel really bad for people that didn't know any better, right? They were just like having your salad, drenching it in this really unhealthy dressing. Also, they throw added sugar in there and all that stuff. And it wasn't until, I believe, last year or maybe the year before that they got rid of all the grapeseed oil and they replaced it with this better for you. It's called high oleic sunflower oil, which is like, technically it's a seed oil, but it's because it's high oleic, it's better for you. It's like, it's got a fatty acid profile similar to avocado oil. But all that is to say is that you don't really know what you're getting when you're eating out in restaurants. And the dose makes the poison with many of these compounds that we know are not great for us. And a little bit here and there is certainly not bad, but it adds up. It adds up. And so that's why I think eating at home, knowing what you're putting in your body is such a powerful point of agency for people to become aware of and then to then manage.
Absolutely. Now, because you do eat out and you know that not everyone's using a clean oil, maybe they have moved over to a high oleic sunflower oil. Great. How are you balancing your omegas internally? Are you supplementing with omega-3s? Keeping your eye on like your fish intake? Like how do you kind of like grapple with knowing what?
Yeah.
It's like unfortunate sometimes when you're like, I know the science of this. And to like have freedom and flexibility, like what's your mindset on that? And how do you think like people listening should approach eating out so they fully enjoy it?
Yeah, you don't want to drive yourself crazy. I mean, I eat out. I know that I'm ingesting some quantity of these grain and seed oils. But you control the controllables, right? Don't stress about the things that you can't control. Instead, control what you can control. And that's why I think it's important for people just to make sure that they're not letting these oils enter their house,
right?
For the most part, make sure that you just throw out the. I mean, generally, I'm not into wasting food, but I would hesitate to even call these foods. Like, throw out the corn oil, the soybean oil, the canola oil, products that contain them. There's so many products now on the market, whether it's spreads or salad dressings that you're looking for that don't utilize any of those crappy oils. And make your primary oil extra virgin olive oil. And when you do that, you don't really have to worry about the omega-6, omega-3 ratio that much. I personally do supplement with fish oil. I take a combined probably 4 grams of EPA and DHA every day, which is high. I don't think that most people need to do that.
About a gram.
Yeah. 1 gram to 2 grams, I think, is going to be sufficient of combined EPA and DHA. Right now, I'm just taking like 4 kind of as an experiment just to see like,
you have a super brain now, Max.
I don't know. I mean, I like doing like blood work occasionally and seeing how things like
change.
How things change.
Like, is it working? That's really important to know that you're not just like throwing stuff down the drain.
Yeah, exactly.
Or peeing it out. Yeah. You wouldn't with that, but yeah.
Right. So you don't have to take 4 grams like I'm doing, but I take 4 grams. Currently. And that's sort of like insurance for me to make sure that I'm still getting my omega-3s. The other problem with like overconsuming these grain and seed oils is that they compete for the same desaturase enzymes that you need to derive EPA and DHA fat from the plant-based omega-3s.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're just taking up space.
Yeah, they're taking up space. And I don't really like to rely on the plant-based omega-3. It's called alpha-linolenic acid, because I know that men in particular were very inefficient at converting that fat to EPA and DHA. So that's why I like to take fish oil. But it's not every day that I consume fish. Grass-fed beef has a little bit of omega-3s. But generally by sticking to mainly whole foods, by limiting your consumption of ultra-processed foods, it really checks it. I mean, it checks so many boxes off for you, that being, I think, one of them.
I love it. Well, I'm so excited for your new book, Genius Kitchen. It's launching very, very soon. We're going to put pre-order stuff in the show notes. I'm going to make those blueberry clusters with my boys. And I love your tips for making the best burger and steak. That's going to be something that everyone's going to be able to take home with them.
Oh, man. Thank you, Kelly. This was so fun. I feel like I could talk to you for hours, but we'd lose listeners. The conversation would devolve.
You're like them again. Oh, gosh. Exactly. Oh, well, it was really fun. And I'm super stoked for you. Gonna snag a copy and make some of Max's recipes.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Well, the book can be found at geniuskitchenbook.com. If you pre-order it, you also get like a bunch of bonuses. We have some really cool stuff. I wrote an ebook called 15 daily steps to lose weight and prevent disease. So that's like a 15-page ebook that you'll get for free if you pre-order at geniuskitchenbook.com, along with a bunch of other things. I wrote an ebook on how to interpret scientific research, also very useful for people. All can be found at geniuskitchenbook.com if you pre-order Genius Kitchen.
Love it. Go grab your extras, go pre-order. We'll put a link to the Genius Kitchen cookbook or geniuskitchenbook.com on my website. All right, Max, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kelly. You're the best.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.